In this episode, you will have to listen if, A, you want help understanding Isaiah and you want Joseph Smith's help as he gets revelation from God, and B, if you have any questions about the facsimiles or you know anyone who has questions about the facsimiles, we're going to give you answers you haven't heard anywhere else and that you'll find fascinating. We'll also give you some fantastic stuff in our Patreon section where we talk about some temple ties, doctrinal ties with the Book of Abraham and the facsimiles and what Joseph is learning and doing in the temple. So join us here for this episode and on the Patreon website, tsar.website. Today is, and this week is kind of a special episode. It's going to be a couple of different parts. First of all, I'm going to share with you some things from Isaiah because we have a revelation where they ask questions about Isaiah. And then in the second part, recorded separately, we're going to go through some things with another Egyptologist, Stephen Smoot. We're going to go through elements of the facsimiles. We're going to look at several different figures and see what we can understand from them, because this is the time period where they would be wrestling with that as well. It's all sorts of fun stuff. I will just say that this is March of 1838. They're in Far West Missouri. That's when we are going to get section 113, where we get the questions about Isaiah. I'm going to address that in just a second, but this is also around the time period where the Book of Abraham translation arrives. It's been sent from Kirtland to Far West, and they read from that. We get that from Anson Call's journal. Thank you, Anson Call. In any case, they read from that, and that helps them to understand some doctrines. And so it's the right time to be looking at the Book of Abraham material. It's also the right time to be talking about Isaiah. And I think it's fascinating. Things are tough. Things are crazy. This is also when Joseph is working on writing his history. We'll get Joseph Smith history coming out from this time period. So he only has a few months in Far West when he flees from Ohio to Missouri. Far West is becoming a large and beautiful community. We should talk about that at least a little bit here for a moment. It was purchased. John Whitmer did a lot of the work on that. They purchased this land. The county was created specifically so that they would have a place for members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to go. Alexander Doniphan helped them to do that in the Missouri State Legislature. And they've been in Clay County for a long time, lots of refugees. There is refugees for 2 years, and the folks in Clay County said, look, we don't want to do to you what happened to you in Jackson County, but we also can't have you just kind of squatting here in almost like refugee camps, as it were, for all this time. And so they approached Alexander Doniphan. He convinced the Missouri legislature to create this county, and that's Caldwell County that they will go to. They divided some area that wasn't a county into Caldwell and Davies County. Davies County would be separate. It was the place for people who weren't members of the church to be able to go. That's not what ended up happening. We'll get back to that later, because that's part of what leads to the expulsion from Missouri. That's important stuff to understand. But for now, we should know that most of the saints are in Far West, and it's a huge city. It's being built the way Joseph had asked them to. They've made this space for the temple that's going to be in the center of the town, and had some dedication ceremonies for groundbreaking ceremonies for the temple. It's the central lot, and then they're building in these large blocks around it in the plans, the same kind of plans Joseph had sent with what they should do in Jackson County. They're now doing it in Far West, and they're trying to create that kind of city that Joseph had asked for. The saints are living there. It's a big, beautiful place. It's becoming the largest. It's on its way of becoming the largest city in Missouri. It has a lot going on. And as part of that, Joseph is there and studying with the saints. They get the Book of Abraham. They read out loud from it together. They also are studying the Book of Isaiah. And as they study Isaiah, and I think it's great that when things are so crazy and so difficult, they're still sitting down and studying the scriptures. And it's nice that you have a prophet who can just ask God some questions. And so Joseph asked God some questions about Isaiah 11, and these are his answers. Now, what I'm going to do is go through these answers and how it changes some things for us as Latter-day Saints, some of our understanding of things. I'm going to share a PowerPoint for those who are watching this on YouTube. For those who aren't, I'm going to just try and describe it well enough for you. So I'm going to show a couple of elements here for you. You can see how olive trees, as they get older, they will rejuvenate, sometimes by just sending new branches straight out of the trunk. So you could call that a rod, or sometimes by having new trees start to grow out of the old roots. And so that's growing out of the roots or out of the stem or the stump. So with that in mind, let's read from section 113, where they ask, who is the stem of Jesse spoken of in the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth verses of the 11th chapter of Isaiah? Verily, thus saith the Lord, it is Christ. What is the rod spoken of in the first verse of the 11th chapter of Isaiah that should come of the stem of Jesse? Behold, thus saith the Lord, it is a servant in the hands of Christ, who is partly a descendant of Jesse, as well as of Ephraim, or of the house of Joseph, on whom there is laid much power. What is the root of Jesse spoken of in the 10th verse of the 11th chapter? Behold, thus saith the Lord, it is a descendant of Jesse, as well as of Joseph, unto whom rightly belongs the priesthood and the keys of the kingdom for an ensign and for the gathering my people in the last days. Now, that last bit, this idea of a descendant of Jesse and of Ephraim that we get in verse 4 and in verse 6, that differs vastly from how most of our Christian friends would interpret this. And of course, all of this is different than how our Jewish friends would interpret this. So I'm going to use some elements from a PowerPoint. I'm not the first one to have recognized how this works. I certainly love teaching this is how it works. My friend Sean Hopkin is the one who designed the PowerPoint slides I'm going to use. Thank you, Dr. Hopkin. We are grateful. He did such a good job. I didn't see a reason to recreate the wheel myself. So we're going to use these wonderful PowerPoints he has. So as we look at this, we're just going to look at chapter 11, verse 1, but based on the interpretation we get from those questions Joseph asked the Lord and got answers to, we're going to look at how, first of all, how traditionally Christians would have interpreted this. So this is using what we call synonymous parallelism, where you get, they say something such as A, and then they say B, and then they say A again in a different way, and B again in a different way, and you usually learn some nuances by saying it in different ways. So they would say that there shall be a rod, that will be A, all right? A rod will come out of the stem or the stump, that's probably a better way of a translation, but something like that, of Jesse, that's B. So you've got rod as A and stump as Jesse, okay? And then a branch, that's A, that's in parallel with rod, a branch shall grow out of his roots. The roots is B. So rod and branch are two ways of saying the same thing. And stem or stump and roots are two ways of saying the same thing. All right. Now we're going to look at this in a restoration way. This is according to section 113. And this is a chiasm. So they're both using a different kind of parallelism. And this is the genius of Isaiah, that he can write something that is using two different parallelistic poetic forms at the same time, and thus says two different things at the same time. And I think both are intended, because that's how Isaiah is. So here we have a chiastic structure, or a chiasm, if we use the section 113 restoration point of view. And there shall come forth a rod, that's A. So a chiasm goes A, B, B, A. All right. So there shall come forth a rod, that's A, out of the stump of Jesse, that's B, and then we get B, and a branch, that's B, shall grow out of his roots, that's A. So rod and roots are in parallel, and stem or stump and branch are in parallel with each other. So let's look at how we would interpret this. If we go with the traditional Christian point of view, we're going to say there shall come forth a rod or a Messiah out of the stump of Jesse, or in other words, out of the house of David. So one way we could say this is, the Messiah will come from the house of David. And then we say, in a branch, that's the Messiah, shall grow out of his roots, or the house of David. So this is the same thing twice. The Messiah is going to come from the house of David. The Messiah is going to come from the house of David. That's the traditional way of interpreting this for Christians. And I mean, it is for Jews as well, only they wouldn't call Christ the Messiah. All right, so that's the traditional way. Now let's look at how how we do this in the restoration perspective, where this is a chiasm, where you say there shall come forth a rod, that's going to be Joseph Smith, or a restoration figure, out of the stump of Jesse, which is basically out of Israel, which would include apostate Christianity, but just out of Israel in general, and what had happened with Israel in the biblical era, especially the time of Christ. So now we go and we say that again, because we did A, that's Joseph Smith or a restoration figure. B is out of Israel or Jesse or Christianity. Now we go B again, and a branch. In this case, we mean the Messiah or the second coming. So the crucified Messiah or apostate Christianity is how we can interpret the first B. The second B is the Messiah or his coming again shall grow out of his roots, meaning out of Joseph Smith or the restoration and a restoration figure. So let me say this again more clearly with this. There shall come forth a restoration that comes from the original Israel and the Messiah, and then the Messiah will return because of the restoration. Both of these are correct. There's no member of the church that would disagree with the interpretation that says that the Messiah will come from the house of David. And I don't think we would disagree that the restoration grows out of original Christianity, original house of Israel, original covenants. And then Christ will come again because of the fulfilling of those covenants in the restoration as we make and keep those covenants. That is fantastic stuff. And hopefully that helps us to recognize what is really going on. Well, many things that are going on here in Isaiah, and how having a prophet in the restoration who will ask God can expand our understanding of things. I am so grateful for that. There is so much to learn because the restoration has made it possible. Now let's jump in and see how that happens with the book of Abraham. Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is also a joint broadcast. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So it's special because it's a joint broadcast and because of the topic. I want to first of all welcome Stephen Smoot. Tell us about your podcast, and then we'll introduce you as well, Stephen. But first of all, tell us the other podcast that this is.
Well, thanks, Kerry, for having me back on the podcast in this fancy new set. Last time I did the podcast, we were just on Zoom, and I was in my my apartment, so it's fun to be here. So the podcast that just launched last week with my co-hosts Neil and Jasmine Rapley is called Informed Saints, produced by a nonprofit organization called the Ancient America Foundation. And the purpose of our podcast, as its name would imply, would be to provide members of the church with the best, most accurate information and resources and study material to make studying the gospel and church history and the scriptures accessible and meaningful, right? So I don't have to tell you how much scholarship is out there. You're on the forefront of producing that scholarship.
Well, as are you.
And for a lot of members of the church, it can be kind of intimidating. Like, you know, what should I read first? And who are some trusted authors and resources I can go to? So a big part of our podcast is to make a lot of this material accessible. We also discuss controversial topics in church history or things happening in the church today that people have questions about or wonder about. So partly our show is meant to address people's questions about church history or the scriptures, but also to help inform them by making accessible scholarship and other resources. So I thought this would be a perfect opportunity for sort of a joint venture, if you will, between our podcasts, since there's a lot of overlap with the wonderful work that you're doing as well.
Well, and your co-hosts are fantastic. They've been doing this kind of thing for a while and are very good at it. And so it's more of a topic-based podcast, whereas ours is following the Come Follow Me schedule, and we bring topics in that work with the Come Follow Me. So it's a good 1-2 punch. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Scriptures Are Real, we follow the Come Follow Me schedule, but we don't try and cover everything. We try and do some deep dives. I bring in my archaeological and historical and linguistic backgrounds and bring on guests that can help us with that to kind of give people maybe some information and some of that scholarship that they wouldn't get in some other places. We love all the podcasts. You can't get enough. There's so much wonderful information to be put out there, and we might as well be putting wonderful information out there because there's a lot of garbage out there as well.
Unfortunately true. So hopefully there's a little light shining within the abysmal darkness that is most of social media these days.
Yeah. We're glad to have Stephen back with us because he's been on the podcast before. Our audience, you may not have been part of our audience. This was almost 4 years ago, about three and more than a half years ago. Stephen was with us when we did Joseph of Egypt and when we did Jonah, I think it was Jonah?
I think it was Jonah, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's been a little while. Stephen is a doctoral candidate. He's working on his dissertation at Catholic University and does both Egyptology, did his master's at the University of Toronto in Egyptology. He's done lots of Hebrew, so he's doing a kind of a combination of Egyptology and biblical stuff in Near Eastern languages.
Right? I call it affectionately a Frankenstein's monster of like a doctoral program, because the full name of my program is Semitic and Egyptian Languages and Literature. And perfect. So, yes, I kind of have 1 foot in Egyptology, 1 foot in Hebrew Bible. I've also done courses in like Aramaic. And then I moonlight doing Latter-day Saint history, right? Yeah. In modern church history as well. So I don't know how many feet that is now. I've lost track of the metaphor.
You're getting to be an octopus. Yeah. No, that's fun. And not dissimilar. So in my PhD, like we had to have a secondary area of emphasis. Mm-hmm. So Egyptology was first, but then Hebrew language and literature, which included Aramaic and Ugaritic and Phoenician and Mobile, all that stuff, right? So it's very similar.
Very similar.
I don't know how, is that a regular thing at Catholic University or is that something you've created?
In my department, the Semitics department, it's pretty standard to have a primary area of emphasis or focus and then to have a secondary area.
Okay.
And so I'm sort of the exact opposite of you. So I'm a primary emphasis Hebrew Bible, secondary Egyptology. Nice. For my PhD. My MA, it was reversed. Right. I was primarily Egyptology, secondary Hebrew Bible. It all just kind of blends together at a certain point, right?
And it's a good way to get well-rounded. Well, wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So let me just explain to the audience, we're just like a week or two, about 2 weeks past when historically Joseph Smith received the papyri and the Book of Abraham translation happened. So that's July through November. There'll be some more stuff that happens in 1842, but the bulk of the activity is July through November of 1835. So that fits between section 107 and 108, but it worked best in terms of topic time to cover it this week. And so we just did this big workshop on the Book of Abraham. But as we did it, I thought, you know what? I wish we had another day where we could do this other thing. And then I thought, well, let's do that with Stephen. What we thought we would do today is to go through the facsimiles, and we probably won't get through every figure in the facsimiles, but we're just going to start going through each number and talk about it from an LDS point of view, from Egyptological or Semitic or ancient point of view. There are lots of ways of approaching this. And that's worth doing. People have questions about it, and there's a lot of fun stuff in there. So maybe, first of all, let's let Stephen, you've got a resource that is just becoming available.
Yes.
That we're going to use today that you can maybe show people. And then I'm just going to do a little bit of background stuff on the facsimile. So go ahead.
My shameless plug will be very brief, but thank you for letting me do it, Kerry. So I have a book that's coming out. So it's called The Pearl of Great Price, a study edition for Latter-day Saints. These are the printer's proofs I just got a couple days ago to do final corrections. It's co-published by Scripture Central and the Interpreter Foundation. Mm. And the long and short of it is I have taken the text of the Pearl of Great Price. I have reformatted and repunctuated it to make it a little more readable. But I've offered running commentary in footnotes, right? So as you're reading the text of the Pearl of Great Price, I make notes mostly on sort of historical or contextual, some linguistic and some doctrinal points, right? So it's meant to be a study edition to, you know, I highlight, for example, textual variants in manuscripts or historical context to certain passages or things like that. And so this should be coming out hopefully soon. I'll do one more shot for the camera here, right? Again, shameless plug, but should be coming out hopefully soon by the time this podcast airs. You can pre-order copies with the Interpreter Foundation on their website, interpreterfoundation.org. Possibly it's, I dare not hope for too much. It might be available by the time this podcast airs, but if not, you should be able to bookmark the page on the Interpreter Foundation to order your copy pretty soon here. And since we're talking about the facsimiles, I should mention, of course, we have our Book of Abraham in here, and it was very fun for me to go through figure by figure. I'll hold it up here if we can see it for the camera. Figure by figure, going through the facsimiles one at a time, providing some brief commentary and explanation. So hopefully this is a resource in addition to the work that you've done, that our colleague John Gee has done, and of course, the great Hugh Nibley to help highlight your...
John Thompson,
of course, another colleague of ours and others, Michael Rhodes. Lots of resources on the facsimiles, and this tries to kind of package them all together in a way to make it accessible for church members.
Which is fantastic. And that's what we need, is to get this available to lots of people. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
There are a number of ways of approaching the facsimiles, and we're going to, I'm sure as we talk about it, jump kind of back and forth a little bit. You can approach them and say, okay, what might the average Egyptian have seen in this in ancient times? We have a limited degree to know that, but we can do our best to figure that out. That's worth looking at. It may be we should be asking, what would ancient Jews have seen in this as they reinterpret Egyptian elements? Because that certainly happened. That's worth looking at. We won't be able to do all of this for all of them. It may have been there are certain Egyptians, especially Egyptian priests from that time period, that are collecting stories about Jews and working it into their own religious beliefs. Maybe that's what we should be looking at. Maybe we should just be saying, what does Joseph Smith want us to get out of this? We don't know. Kind of regardless of what ancient people, a lot of ways of approaching this. We'll just look at all sorts of interesting things that could work. Sometimes this approach or the one for that approach. Because there's so many fun and interesting things to do. So
I should note that those approaches aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, which is what makes studying the facsimiles interesting. So my kind of default approach to the facsimiles, so I have one approach as an Egyptologist where I try to, as you said, do my best to understand in their original Egyptian context, what might the sort of the face value understanding or interpretation of these figures have been. Not always easy to figure out, but I think for most of the time we can have a pretty good understanding. But there's additional layers on that. And one of them that I'm really interested in is how Joseph Smith, as a seer and a prophet who revealed the translation of the inspired translation of Abraham's writings, I believe he, as a prophet, was actively engaged in the act of the fancy term is syncretism, is what scholars use, where you recontextualize symbols or images and bring them over, translate them, if you will, into a new significant context for a new audience, religious or otherwise. I think that he's also actively engaging in that to a degree with his explanations. And so those different methodologies you've outlined, you can sort of line them up and approach them all together and see what interesting results you get.
I agree. And that's the beauty of symbols. They are intended to yield multiple meanings. And often in the ancient world, they wanted those multiple meanings to be speaking at the same time. Right. And so it may be that what Joseph Smith is revealing to us also matches with some other things. This could happen a lot of different ways. Or ancient priests collecting Jewish stories and Jews at the same time. Sometimes they're going to come up with the same interpretation and sometimes different, right? So you're right.
Right.
This is, we don't know exactly how to approach this, so we'll approach it lots of ways.
Yeah, great.
I have also brought, this is a facsimile edition of the Times and Seasons.
It's so a facsimile of a facsimile, in other words?
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. So this is what the original publication of the Times and Seasons looked like, so that we can see that. We're not going to like go off that necessarily, but it's fun. They did try to make these life size, so this isn't life size necessarily, but the original facsimile 2 was a fold out because it was larger than the other papyri. This isn't the exact same size.
It's probably kind of close to scale from other hypocephali we have, right? It's fun. So I collect old editions of the scriptures, one of my little hobbies. And I own some older editions of the Pearl of Great Price from the 19th century. So the edition that Orson Pratt did in 1876 that the church canonized, and they have a fold out of facsimile too. So they continued that up until the 20th century. I'm all about normalizing fold outs in our scriptures. Let's bring back facsimile to fold outs.
Sounds good to me. Sounds good to me. I should say that one of the donors who donated to create the studio, he showed me, he has an original Times and Seasons.
Oh, great. Edition. Yeah.
That's really cool. But anyway, all right.
For sure.
So let's jump in. Okay. Should we start with facsimile 1, figure 1? That seems like a good place to start.
Yeah.
So why don't you start us off and tell us some of the things you see there?
Okay. So facsimile 1, figure 1, the angel of the Lord. That's the description that Joseph Smith gives it in his explanation. I should note, as I've mentioned, that Joseph Smith is actively tying in these figures with the Abraham text he revealed and that he gives us, right?
Right.
So everything that's happening in facsimile 1 ties in with Abraham chapter 1, where this bird figure is meant to illustrate the angel of the Lord. I personally believe it's Jehovah himself based on texts, clues in the text. But in any case, a divine personage, a divine figure who comes and rescues Abraham from his near sacrifice. Again, within the context of the story, it makes sense why you would want to tie in a bird-like, seemingly heavenly creature with this divine personage or figure that rescues Abraham. I don't know how much we want to go in depth necessarily in the original Egyptian context. Maybe it's worth just pointing out for the benefit of our conversation that both facsimile one and facsimile three appeared on the same papyrus that Joseph Smith had.
Owned by Hor the priest
in Thebes from around 250 or 150 BC, right?
Yeah, 150, 200,
somewhere in that neighborhood,
yeah.
Ptolemaic period in Thebes, the big Karnak temple there. So that's sort of our immediate Egyptian context in Hor's sort of religious context that he probably would have understood these figures is they are appended to his Book of Breathings, this text to help him in the afterlife, right? And so in that context, many have interpreted this bird-like figure to perhaps be what we call the Ba,
right?
That's a difficult concept to sort of conceptually and literally translate today. The soul, the spirit, the self, you know, it's some fundamental aspect of the human person that the ancient Egyptians believed constituted a human person. The Ba can ascend into the afterlife. It can be sent and summoned. It can be a divine helper or an assistant. So you can call upon the Ba to do things for you, at least in the Ptolemaic period. Right. So our colleague John Gee has a great article where he talks about, like, again, Ba's can be summoned and sent as if they were messengers, angeloi, and in ancient Greek, that's what they get syncretized as, or sort of conceptually, they fill that role that Greeks in Egypt understand as messengers, angeloi, right? So, and helpers, those are sort of the two Greek terms they use to describe the Ba as it's conceptualized. So,
and in fact, when they start to translate the Coptic, so the latest phase of Egyptian Ba into Greek, that's what they translated into is angeloi. Right?
Yeah.
That's the equivalent.
That and paraderos I'm looking at here. Yeah. So like attendant or assistant.
Yeah.
Gods have Ba's, by the way, ancient Egyptian gods. And so again, conceptually the idea of Jehovah, right? You're going to have to sort of think more abstractly here than we're kind of used to in our modern Judeo-Christian monotheistic perspective. But the idea of a God sending his messenger or presence down to a person to assist them in some way, that's what the Ba does in its funerary context. That's what Jehovah does in the Book of Abraham. Yeah. So I can see the logic that Joseph Smith is making this connection as he is recontextualizing these figures to fit this Abrahamic narrative.
And that's even a biblical phrase, the angel of his presence.
Totally.
Right. That's not an idea that is foreign to the Israelites either. So,
right.
Yeah. And this, it's how, if you were trying to depict something in a way that could speak both Egyptian and Israelite, then this is how I would expect you would depict an angelos or an angel or a Ba.
So, great.
It makes great sense. So, all right, then. Let's
we're one figure down. How are we doing?
we won't get all the way, but let's do a couple more. So
maybe, Harry, can I ask you a question real quick, if you don't mind? Maybe we could address real quick. Some people have questions or concerns about. So if you look at the original papyrus image, there's damaged portions of the original vignette. That's your fancy word of the day is vignette is what we Egyptologists use to describe basically pictures that the Egyptians drew for their texts. Right. So you look at the original vignette. Go on the Joseph Smith Papers website where they have great high-res images. You'll notice there's a big chunk missing in the middle.
Yeah.
And some have made the claim that Joseph Smith kind of bungled this when he drew in these figures, right? This figure three, the standing figure, should really have the head of a jackal. And, well, he shouldn't be holding a knife. He should be holding something else, right? So, like, there's some of these questions or concerns people have raised. Do we want to tackle this real quick or maybe give us your thoughts on Joseph Smith's reconstruction of facsimile one?
Yeah, let's talk about it at least a little bit. Again, all of this we could go far more into depth, and I have published on this in an Egyptological journal about this drawing. So one of the issues is if you look at the original, there are glue marks where the broken parts are. So the head part of the arm of the priest with the knife and part of the arms of the person on the altar are missing. But the glue marks make it look like unless they were gluing more sloppily there than everywhere else in all the places where they glued papyri, which is possible, but less likely. So if they glued as precisely here as elsewhere, then at one point they had that part of the papyrus and it broke off eventually, maybe after Joseph's death. We don't know when.
Yeah.
So they may have had that, although someone does draw it in. You can see on the backing paper that it's drawn in there. So probably it breaks off earlier, but it's fairly likely that they had that originally based on the glue marks, but we can't tell. So some other things to identify or ask about. Some people have thought these aren't hands being put up, but wings.
Of a second bob bird, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right, of a bird. And that is possible, but Lanny Bell is an Egyptologist who, when he looked at it carefully, said, no, I think these are hands. Mm-hmm. As I look at it, I think it's hands. It works much better that way than as wings. So those likely are hands. Maybe some people have argued this to be a jackal-headed figure because that's what you often find in this kind of scene. But this is different than all, it's completely unique. So it's possible that that figure is also unique. There are a lot of other things that are unique about this.
Right.
In some ways, it's irrelevant because when they draw the jackal-headed figure, what they are drawing is a priest
yeah.
wearing a jackal mask.
Head. And we have examples of that, right? Of the actual headdress that priests would put on themselves in the performance of these funerary rites.
See the eye holes. You can see where it goes over their shoulder.
And he's being led by another priest in some of these depictions. He's kind of holding him by the waist because of these giant cumbersome things. The only reason I bring this up and think it's worth pointing out directly, Carrie, is... our figure three, the idolatrous priest of Elkanah attempting to offer up Abraham as a sacrifice. Again, that's tying back into Abraham one. You, in this article that you've published recently, and others have touched on this as well, the idea of having the knife, and by the way, it looks like a flint knife that was used in execration rituals. And that's an important context to the Egyptian elements underlining this vignette, right?
Yeah. And that argues for them having seen it initially, because this is not probably the way Joseph Smith would draw a knife if he's just thinking of knives that he knows.
Yeah.
But this is the way you would expect this ritual knife to look.
We even have them archaeologically, these little flint crescent shaped. It looks exactly like it.
Anyway, sorry, keep going.
Well, this is just to say, if we go to figure three, right, he's attempting to offer up Abraham as a sacrifice. This has been one of the elements that many Egyptologists have kind of balked at or have criticized Joseph Smith for. They'll say, understandably, in the context of the Book of Breathings, this should be a scene of the mummification or resurrection of the deceased on a lion couch, right? That's commonly where this context appears, as the resurrection and the revivification of the deceased on his funerary bier. Right. But if we do have a knife there, which it seems is original to the scene, and from other evidence that we don't have to get into here, it seems like you can't totally neglect or push away a sacrificial, or I should say, sacred violence element of the scene, right?
Yeah.
And the article that you've published and that you and John Gee have written on, right? Like, that may not be the entire context, but it is part of the context, an important part of the context of these scenes of the resurrection of Osiris and or the deceased owner of the Book of Breathings would have been some kind of a sanctioned violence against the enemies of Osiris. And so I see, again, there another convergence where Joseph Smith's interpretation makes sense in light of the ancient Egyptian context here as he refits it into the context of our story, which is about Abraham being sacrificed.
I would agree very much. It fits incredibly well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Along with the drawing and everything else. So good. And figure two is, so we've talked about figure three a little bit. Again, whether he had a jackal mask or not, but in this context where it doesn't seem funerary because of the knife and a couple of other things, it may not have been a jackal head one way or the other. It's a priest, whatever they're depicting.
Well, that's a justifiable interpretation of it.
There's
other Egyptologists who have identified it as a priest.
Yeah.
So you can go, both ways in that interpretation.
But figure two is Abraham. Am I remembering right? Yeah. Abraham. Yeah. Egyptologically, you wouldn't know who exactly this is. You would kind of expect it to be Hor because of its placement, and it could be Hor, but also, there's a part of me that wonders if Hor is using this for both a Book of Breathings and a Book of Abraham. Mm. Again, we can't tell. We don't know. Or is this Joseph giving us this other inspired interpretation, regardless of what Hor would have seen? There's so many possibilities.
Right.
But it is a unique drawing in many ways. That figure is drawn. There are things that are similar to other drawings, but there are some things that are different than anywhere else, including the way it's drawn in our facsimile is not the way it is in the original in terms of the placement of the priest.
This is figure three, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, three and two together. It has to be both.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The priest, figure three, is in the original. So Reuben Hedlock, who made this carving, just got this. He does a great job, but he got this part a little wrong. That figure three of the priest is in between the legs of figure two, or Abraham, and the altar, which is four, right? That's figure four, yeah. So that's there. You can find, I think, if I remember right, one other example of a similar placement, but not any examples that have all of these elements,
other constituit
together.
Elements
yeah,
together.
Yeah, it yeah. is. It's very unique.
None of them where he has his hands raised in front of his head, as I understand,
yeah.
And where there's probably the flint execration knife, yeah. ritual knife being used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the way with the dress, the legs movement, and so on. Anyway, and that seems to be depicting some kind of movement of either trying to get on or off the altar or something like that, where the priest is in between. And it doesn't seem like it would be on, because then the priest's in the way. But anyway,
yeah.
So it's hard to know exactly what to do with that.
Yeah.
Figure four, I don't know if you want to say very much about that, or I mean, it's the altar, right?
It's the altar in its funerary context. It's these, we have abundant examples of these lying couches, right? We have non-funerary examples. The birthing scene of Hatshepsut at Deir el-Bahri or Deir el-Medina.
Yeah.
Can't remember which one, but she's being birthed on a lying couch, right? So we have examples of her there. During the Ptolemaic period, these Apis bull altars where they're sacrificing the Apis bull.
Yeah.
Some of them, these alabaster altars, some of them are carved with in relief, these yeah. lion heads, right? So
yeah, and those may be both sacrifice and mummification, it's
right.
hard to tell. But
again, the lines are blurred in some of these contexts
yeah.
since they kind of blend together in their overall purpose or function.
Well, this is worth talking about just for a moment as well. We may not get very far on this, but let's have fun with what
okay.
we do.
Yeah.
And then maybe we'll reprise another day and do more. In, say, like Philistines, ancient Israel, similar places, their altars often have horns on them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And whenever students ask me what that means, then we start to talk about symbolism. And I usually will say, well, the two most powerful animals in the ancient Near East, that they were powerful partially because of the fear you had of them, were bulls and lions. And so they would put these horns evoking the horn is kind of where you feel the power of the bull.
Yeah.
Evoking this bull horns on these altars because it was symbolic of power. And I don't know why it took me so many years of talking about that to realize, oh, wait, bulls and lions, the Egyptians take the lion route.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think it is evocative of power.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. An altar needs to have power, or else what you do on it doesn't have any efficacy in any other realm other than that you just killed something, right?
Right.
So I think that this is evocative. It's just my opinion. I haven't done any study of this or anything, but I think that it's evocative of power to have this be a lion couch. That's the phrase we often use, is yeah. lion couch. But lion on an altar, it means that this has power to affect multiple realms. That's my personal opinion. Anyway,
very interesting. Maybe because I know we want to hop over to effects simile two and three, at least a yeah. little bit. The only other thing I'd like to point out, if we can, before we hop over, is the fun combination of figures 11 and 12.
Is it right if we just quickly say for 5, 6, 7,
oh, yeah,
and
sure.
8, which we would normally call the sons of Horus and canopic jars, where they mummify different parts of the, I'll speak the way that, some of my relatives did when I was growing up, they mummified the innards.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. But anyway, that is what you would normally say, but in this form of syncretism that you have mentioned, very, very common, incredibly common to have gods from one area be equated with a god in another area,
right,
and be depicted in the same way. That happens everywhere. Anyone who tells you these have to be interpreted in a specific way is ignoring a huge amount of evidence in Egypt that the Egyptians also syncretized with other gods.
Right.
And so could you have these four gods that are known by specific names in Egypt be syncretized with Canaanite gods?
Absolutely.
Of course you could. It does happen.
It's attested. We know they're doing
this.
Are, when Greeks come in contact with the Egyptians, they do this. When Canaanites come in contact, they do this.
Yeah.
It's standard operating procedure in the ancient world to syncretize your deities. And indeed in the Book of Abraham, Elkanah, the god Elkanah, he's a attested Northwest Semitic deity. He is syncretized by Abraham's kinsfolk with the god of Pharaoh, right? Who is said to be figure 9, by the way, the Sobek crocodile
right.
here, right? Or perhaps Horus. Either way, the god of Pharaoh, right? So yeah, that works very well there.
Mm-hmm. And all four of these gods are attested anciently. Yeah. Joseph Smith, if he made up these names, he is the luckiest guesser ever. But really, he gives us names of gods that exist in the right time and place. And so that's just worth pointing out. Anyway, go ahead with your combination.
So, yeah, real quick, I want to highlight numbers 11 and 12 because this touches on actually my dissertation topic, which is creation, cosmogony, the fancy term for the birth of the cosmos, right? The origins of the universe. The Egyptians have cosmogony.
So just to our audience, hopefully you hear the roots of Genesis.
Yeah.
In cosmogony. So you've got cosmogenesis, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So. And of course, the ancient Egyptians have cosmogony myths. The origins of the universe are, we don't like to use the term myth per se, but it's a creation myth, a creation story, a creation account in Genesis. And a big part of my dissertation is focusing on those. Figure 11, Joseph Smith says, is designed to represent the pillars of heaven as understood by the Egyptians. And I'll get to that in just a moment. And figure 12, here's your Hebrew for the day, Rakia, Raukiang is how Joseph Smith transliterates it based on the Hebrew system he was taught. Rakia, signifying expanse or firmament above our heads, right? And then this, he says, meant to signify the Hebrew term Shamayim, heavens or sky. So in other words, you have the pillars holding up the sky, okay?
Right.
The pillars holding up the Rakia, the firmament. This is a textbook ancient Israelite and Egyptian cosmology, where they believe and understand that there's like a dome-like sort of structure that are holding up, being supported by four pillars on the cardinal points of the compass, northeast, southwest, and above the dome, it's separating the heavenly waters. In the Genesis creation account, right, God makes a firmament in the midst of the waters and separates it, and there's waters below, and there's waters above, right?
Right.
And what is in facsimile one? We have these pillars, we'll get to this in a second, and it's holding up these zigzag lines of water, okay? Mm-hmm. So very nice bullseye there for Joseph Smith to tap into this well-attested ancient cosmology of the expanse of the firmament holding up the waters being supported by the four pillars.
Yeah. And we should also say that the Egyptians often depicted the sky as a waterway.
Yeah. Exactly. So, but Joseph Smith says designed to represent the pillars of heaven as understood by the Egyptians. So I looked into this, and first of all, that phrase pillars of heaven, that's an attested Egyptian phrase all the way back to the Old Kingdom, pyramid texts, some of the oldest religious and creation texts we have from Egypt in the pyramid texts. Right. That phrase pillars of heaven appears there. And it appears in the time period that facsimile one was drawn.
Right.
And in your recent article on this, you touched on how in its sort of funerary context here, figure 11 may represent the niched facade of the temple where Hor was a priest, serving as a priest. That converges very nicely with the idea of these being the pillars of heaven. Right. This is attested as a conceptual linkage. If the temple is a microcosm and Hor is a part of this, then you just sort of project it a little more further outward in this more expansive view that Joseph Smith has, and it works very well.
Yeah, and it fits perfectly with temple symbolism and the way Egyptians conceived of temple symbolism, because the temple was symbolizing the cosmos and cosmogony, that beginning of the cosmos. So,
in fact, at Karnak, if I'm not mistaken, they had the primeval hillock, or they believed, right? Yeah. There was most Egyptian temples, not all of them, had some sense of like, you have a sacred lake that represents the primordial waters, and you have a primeval hillock, the first land that sprang out of that water, and Egyptian temples, they're wanting to recreate that and sort of recreate the cosmos around it by building temples around it.
Yeah, exactly right. Maybe I'll just say quickly in passing that nine, the crocodile, during Abraham's day, the crocodile has a strong association with Pharaoh, and that's what Joseph Smith says. And anyway, there are some more fun symbols we could do there, but
yeah,
we'll do that another time. But it is fun and interesting.
I think, what are we going to do with facsimile two? We could spend a lot of time here. Do we just want to hit a couple of our favorites or some highlights?
Probably, because
maybe we can plug the great book, One Eternal Round by Hugh Nibley and Michael Rhodes, came out about 15 years ago after Hugh Nibley had passed away. They have a pretty exhaustive analysis of the hypocephalus. And even if I may have some quibbles here or there with some other approach, I think overall it holds up very well in terms of giving you a grounded understanding of the hypocephalus. Tamás Mekés, a great Hungarian Egyptologist, published this recently. The Hypocephalus, an ancient Egyptian funerary amulet. This is a great resource if you want to get a Egyptological perspective on what facsimile 2 is, which is a hypocephalus. Mekish even has some notes in translation on facsimile 2, our facsimile 2. He has a discussion on it. So if you want a Latter-day Saint perspective, I'd say see Hugh Nibley, Michael Rhodes. If you want a non-Latter-day Saint, Tomasz Mekish is a great resource for that.
Excellent. And maybe what we can do, we're just figuring this out as we go.
Sure.
Let's just touch on a couple of highlights and then let's state our intent that we will get together to do another joint broadcast
this time in your studio.
And yeah, we'll do facsimile 2.
We'll rip it apart. Yeah. We'll do a long deep dive into facsimile 2. Perfect.
With all these different figures we're going to discuss, let's start with one.
Perfect.
Okay. So figure one, Joseph says, is Kolob signifying the first creation nearest to the celestial or the residence of God, first in government? And we don't need to read the whole thing, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
With that.
It's a long explanation.
It is a long explanation. The Kolob, interestingly enough, is a Semitic root that means like center or heart, near the center or heart.
Something
like
that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. It's also associated in at least Arabic with stars. Mm-hmm. And so that works really well. Egyptologically, I would typically say that center figure we would say is Amun-Ra.
Yeah.
Who is, it's hard to say the creator god because there are lots of different creator gods in Egypt and in different contexts and in different time periods, there are different the creator gods. But in Thebes, he is the creator god. And that's where this guy we know a little bit less, but this is likely coming from Thebes. So he is the creator god. One of the things that I love that I think our audience will find interesting, you see he's a two-headed figure there facing two different directions. In most of the hypocephali, you actually get four-headed figures, but two-headed is not impossible. In any case, those can mean a couple things. It does have this ability to see is part of it, mm-hmm. but probably the primary thing being depicted there is a unity, two different beings coming together. Mm.
Interesting.
To be together, which is what Amun-Ra actually is two beings.
Two deities.
Two deities.
Speaking of syncretism.
Exactly right. They have merged together and they have been syncretized to the point where they are two and one. And you get these phrases like Amun is at rest in Ra and Ra and Amun and so on.
Right.
But for me, from a Latter-day Saint point of view, as I think about this and kind of this journey and that being where God is, and if I compare it to Abraham chapter 3, where God seems to be saying, this is where I am, but inherent in there with the idea that we'll be proved therewith, and then we can receive glory forever and ever is this idea we can join with God. And then I think of John chapter 17 and so on.
Becoming one with God. Yeah, sure.
That this, in some ways, may be a depiction of our unity with God, of us becoming one with God. That really speaks to me, I have to say. So that's a little bit of Egyptology mixed with a little bit of LDS theology, which is to some degree what we're trying to do here. And that means something to me. You had some more on
I was just going to add, I think you're right that in its Egyptian context, this is probably Amun or Amun-Ra. I think another hypocephali, he is labeled as such, right? Which is a helpful methodology to help us understand how at least some ancient Egyptians identified this figure. All I wanted to add to that was in my commentary, again, as I kind of go through the figure by figure and the facsimiles in my new book coming out, I just mentioned that Amun-Ra is the primeval self-generating creator god whose name in Egyptian means the hidden one or the concealed one. And the idea
is, or at least the Amun part, right?
Yeah, the Amun part of it, Imana, to be hidden or concealed. And it's kind of hard to fully wrap our minds around what they may have meant by this, but the sense seems to have been that in some sense, Amun-Ra is like the underlying primordial element of which all creation springs out of. And we have these myths where like all the gods descend out of Amun, who's like this, he's this primordial presence, generative presence.
An unknowable, ununderstandable.
And you can only access him through his emanations that are created out of him. It's again, very kind of conceptually hard to wrap our minds around. But the bullseye here for Joseph Smith, Kolob signifying first creation, right. That element is accords very nicely with this figure. Yeah. And so
very much so.
So
all creation springs from there. It's the center of creation. And then everything else is gauged by how it relates to that.
Right. So excellent. Otherwise, just wanted to add that one little note there.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. Yeah. We could really talk about this for a long time. Number six, I'm just going to touch on quickly. I will read again in Joseph's explanation, represents this earth in its four quarters. Those would be typically thought of as the four sons of Horus. Again, mm-hmm. the same guys that we had in their shorter canopic jar form under the altar in facsimile one. These are the same characters who are typically associated with that canopic function, but also are associated each one with one of the cardinal points
right.
or with the four quarters of the earth. This is strikingly striking perfect match, or as you've said, a bullseye with what Joseph Smith is saying. It's hard to just disregard that.
Right.
And maybe I'll just say this. I've said this a number of places and I will continue to say it, but hopefully it's been illustrated a little bit by the little bit we're doing before you go on, because I want people
sure.
to be thinking
yeah.
of this as they hear what you're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
If you go through the facsimiles by the numbers or a whole bunch of other things, there are so many things that what Joseph Smith said that we can say, wow, that really works well, given a number of different possible methodologies. It's still, in so many of them, it works really, really, really well. And there are a couple that we say, I'm not quite sure exactly how that works.
Mm-hmm.
The number that, as a believing Latter-day Saint, that I have to say, I don't quite know how that works, is fairly small. If I'm a non-believer and I'm trying to say, okay, well, how do I explain all the matches Joseph Smith had? That number is really, really, really high.
Yeah.
So from an intellectual statistical point of view, in my opinion, it requires more faith to disbelieve than it does to believe. You have to be so convinced of your disbelief that you will operate on faith on that, even when the disbelief doesn't match what you think it should. You have to do that far more than a believer has to do it. Both are going to have to exercise some faith.
Right.
It takes, in my opinion, it takes more faith to disbelieve when we start looking at these facsimiles, which is interesting because so many people hear, oh, the facsimiles, Joseph Smith is so wrong.
He got
wrong.
Nothing We're, right. Yeah. I've heard that before.
Yeah.
He got all of it wrong.
So wrong.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop believing when you go through it, it's the opposite. It's incredibly faith affirming.
Yes, I completely agree. And I'm reminded of a recently departed Egyptologist who was very critical and vocally critical of Joseph Smith's interpretations of the facsimiles. And he published a book on the Joseph Smith papyri and on the facsimiles, and he gave his own interpretations. And there are several points where he either had to say this was an easy guess by Joseph Smith, or he would quibble and say, well, okay, that's how it's identified, but that's not its primary function or purpose. And so he had to kind of prevaricate a little bit by saying, and I just think, like, at what point do the lucky guesses no longer become lucky guesses, but they become that Joseph Smith is actually genuinely tapping into and revealing something that has deep, authentic, genuine roots in antiquity, both in the world of Abraham and in the world of the ancient Egyptians from which these illustrations came. So I'm in agreement with you there. I can't explain everything with the tools of scholarship. I have questions myself. There's a lot that there's enough that Joseph Smith gets right that I can't just say that there's nothing happening here. It's all just easy guesses. Eventually it snowballs into something more than just a lucky or easy guess for him.
No, the odds of him making this many easy guesses are so astronomically small that really requires faith. And so I'm just going to turn something on its head a little bit, because what I hear frequently is someone on YouTube trying to say something like, the secrets that the LDS Church doesn't want you to know about the Book of Abraham. And then I said, like, Joseph Smith got all this wrong. Well, in reality, this is the secrets that those YouTubers don't want you to know.
Yeah.
They don't want you to know that this is matches so incredibly well that I have both a spiritual and an intellectual testimony and they don't want you to know how well it matches. This is the dark hidden secret of anti-Book of Abrahamers.
Yeah.
So we're revealing those dark, terrible
secrets. There you go. You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Well, maybe if we can hop over to figure seven, this is a figure that I find really interesting. And when we co-published a book a few years ago on the Book of Abraham, we had a whole chapter.
Oh, I was going to bring that
seven.
Book and show everyone.
Oh, well, but another shameless plug. Yeah. It's entitled A Guide to the Book of Abraham. We're like 40 minutes into it. Now we plug our book. It's for free on the BYU Studies website, or you can Google A Guide to the Book of Abraham.
It's actually a volume in BYU Studies. Yeah. So if you just get it on BYU Studies and search for that, or you just Google BYU Studies Guide to the Book of Abraham,
you should pull it up there. And we have a chapter on figure seven. I just want to address this real quick, because this is a figure, again, I see skeptical critics of Joseph Smith or other internet polemicists on YouTube or TikTok. They make a big deal about figure seven. And I don't know why, because it's actually another kind of bullseye for Joseph Smith. If I were trying to be critical of the man, I probably wouldn't try to highlight the thing that works really well for him. So figure seven represents God sitting upon his throne, revealing through the heavens the grand key words of the priesthood, as also the sign of the Holy Ghost unto Abraham in the form of a dove. So let's pick this apart one by one. Represents God. And by the way, for figure seven, those who can't see it, who are listening, this is this upside down seated figure on sort of the bottom right quarter of the facsimile. He's seated on a throne. He has one arm raised. He's in profile, so he's probably meant to sort of raise it to the square or raise it sort of above his head. We'll talk about what's happening in the other protrudence coming out of his stomach there, it looks like. And we have this little figure presenting what's called the wedge-out eye. We'll break all this down. Okay, so represents God sitting upon his throne. Yes, the predominant interpretation Egyptologically is this is either Min or Amun Min. Again, another syncretized deity. Min is another very old, widely worshipped Egyptian creator and fertility deity, right? One of our oldest excavated sites from Egypt is at Koptos, where they had a temple to Min, and they had a big statue of Min outside of the temple, right? So he's an old deity, been worshipped for a while.
And very much associated with creation.
Creation, fertility, specifically male creativity and fertility. Virility and so forth. So, okay, God sitting upon his throne. He has one arm raised in the square, and he's holding what appears to be a flagellum. It's kind of drawn like a little, like a compass almost, right? It seems to be from other hypocephali and examples. I mean, he's holding a flagellum or like a flail. That's a kingly symbol, right? And in that context, he is understood to be exercising sort of kingly dominion, specifically in the context of protecting his temple at Koptos. So some Egyptologists have gone so far as to say that when he is in this, and this is also the classic smiting pose, we were going to say, where the Egyptian monarch, he has some kind of weapon, usually a mace, sometimes a flail
sometimes a little spear.
He's smiting the enemies that are trying to transgress sacred space or disturb the cosmos or whatever. So that's one aspect. So God sitting upon his throne. Yeah, no problem there. What's this little protrudence at his side? This is what gets a lot of people kind of exercised and upset, right? So in some depictions of Min and in some hypocephali, this is Min's phallus.
Yeah.
And that's
a male member for
a male member. Yes. His male member. And that can be shocking for some. And this is how people on the internet try to spin it. The shocking thing that the Mormons believe that God has a male member, a phallus, right? Well, hold on. Let's take a second here. Yes. In that concept and in that status as a fertility and a creator God, the male member becomes one of the preeminent symbols for rejuvenation, virility, fertility, creation. Right. So conceptually,
and
this
especially works, for men, actually.
And for men, absolutely.
That's probably the most common way that men is depicted.
Yeah. So again, it may be kind of shocking to some people's religious sensibilities, but for the ancient Egyptians, it's not a problem. And for Joseph Smith's explanation, this isn't a problem. I will also point out there are other hypocephali where it's not necessarily a phallus, but it is Min, and he has another arm at his side like this. So some depictions...
Sticking out.
He has his arm sticking out at his side, and he has one arm raised up, and he's about to whack somebody with his flail. In some hypocephali, he's the one extending the wedge-out eye to this other figure. In others, he's receiving it. Here, he appears to be receiving it from the figure, right?
So it very well may be an arm extended out to receive.
It could be. We can't know for sure because we don't have the original. We only have our copy.
Which, by the way, now I'm going to throw in just a little bit of Israelite temple stuff. And I have a book on the temple that I've submitted that I assume will be coming out in about a year or something like that, where I draw on my master's thesis, which is that you receive what you need in mm-hmm. temple context, and there is a temple context to this, in the palm of your hand. And
right.
it's often with an arm that is kind of held out like that, with this palm ready to receive it. And yep. given that you have someone presenting a wedgie, that's a very realistic idea for what is being depicted there. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this is not the male member, because that's really common with men. But in this context, it very well could be
yeah.
an arm extended out, kind of a bent arm extended out. That's very common in Egyptian yep. to depict it that way, with an open palm ready to receive
right.
this wedgie.
So in either case, though, which yeah. we can't say for sure.
Which one it is. Yeah.
Which one
and
it
they
is.
They both work.
And they both work. Exactly. So yeah. Whatever your religious or polemical sensibilities may say about being uncomfortable with this, it works for Joseph Smith's explanation. Let's just touch on one more aspect here. Revealing the grand key words of the priesthood. So without getting into the specifics of the temple context, God raising the right arm and extending his hand, right? These from an Israelite and a Latter-day Saint perspective.
Right, right.
That
we
works
that
out
in
very well.
The tabernacle
well.
And the Temple of Solomon and so on, right? So,
exactly. Yeah. The other aspect of this is, what is the wedjot eye? Ujjah in Egyptian, it means like health or wholesomeness, mm-hmm. right? To be hale, right.
Yeah,
to be healthy.
Yeah, in some ways, to be whole.
To be whole, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. the eye, in the classical formulation of the myth, it's the eye that Horus has to restore because right. it's been taken. So it's sometimes called the eye of Horus,
yeah,
right?
His eye is plucked out and his mother helps him get this new eye that makes him whole. And it's a better, it's a bionic it's, eye.
Yeah, that's right. Point. It's yeah. A cyber eye. But yeah. as part of the myth is the idea is to be fully resurrected and deified, your body has to be whole. And so you can't have any missing parts and you can't like, and there's these great, you know, these texts from the underworld where guys are walking and their heads are twisted on backwards or they're upside down or whatever. Something's wrong with their body. Yeah. That's a bad fate for you in the afterlife. So what's happening here is Nehebka'u, by the way, he's the Egyptian figure probably. In some hypocephali, this figure is either an anthropomorphic snake or sometimes he's a hawk or a bird. And
yeah,
here
bird.
He seems to be a hawk or a bird.
Yeah. That's the one that's holding the wedge.
He's holding it and presenting it to men, right?
Yeah.
Again, what's going on here is he is presenting him the preeminent symbol of wholeness, of rejuvenation, of resurrection, of the ability to be deified with your whole body, right? And again, from a Latter-day Saint temple experience, this resonates very well with our understanding of the purpose of the temple and why we go to the temple, make covenants, and why indeed the key words of the priesthood are revealed to us in the temple.
Right.
So
that we can be made whole.
We can be made whole and receive deification and exaltation, resurrection in God's presence, right?
Right.
So again, people on the internet want to just take the little snapshot. Oh, Mormons believe God has a phallus. I hear it all the time. It's this shocking got you, right? Meant to sort of disturb people. But break down the constituent parts. Joseph Smith's explanation works very well here in terms of how this works. So figure seven, again, I refer to our chapter in our book, A Guide to the Book of Abraham, where we discuss this more in depth. But hopefully those few points will suffice to now to kind of whet your appetite and show, again, get beyond the sensationalism, dig deep down. And what we see is the Egyptian elements converge very nicely with Joseph Smith's explanation yeah. as he is attempting to relate it and recontextualize it with our Book of Abraham.
Well said. That's a good place for us to end.
We'll have to say facsimile 3 for
yeah.
another day. Facsimile
yeah.
3 is a whole other beast, right? So
yes,
we'll take care of that another time.
Yeah, and we have a friend who did his thesis on that, and that's that'll be worth
yeah.
bringing up as
I'll quickly mention, yeah, Quinton Barney. Mm-hmm. On the BYU website, if you type in his thesis, it's called The Neglected Facsimile, An Analysis of Facsimile 3. Quinton, I believe you were on his committee for that, right?
I was the committee chair for that thesis.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have two endorses here. It's very excellent work. The long and short of it is facsimile 3, just so we don't leave people hanging too much here. Historically, Egyptologists have said this must be a judgment scene from the Book of the Dead, chapter 125. That's almost certainly not correct now,
yeah.
from what we can tell. It is, in fact, what we would call a presentation scene,
right.
where, in this case, the owner of the papyrus, Hor, has already been deemed Ma'acheru, true of
right.
voice, justified.
Right.
He's
so it's,
been
it's
vindicated.
Like the follow-up to the judgment.
The
scene,
follow-up. And
were.
He is being brought into the presence of the deity Osiris for the purpose of becoming an Osiris. And one of the little columns, the text says that he may be at the side of the seat of Osiris, right? And so it's a deification scene in the postmortem realm. So that well, again, a teaser for our next conversation, perhaps, of doing just Facsimile 3, but there's a lot of interesting stuff to go on there.
Yeah, because it does work with what Joseph is saying, but we'll have to talk about that another time. So, but hopefully this has been useful for our audience to at least talk a little bit about this, because part of what I hope you will see is that these things that are coming in 1835, and we don't, the explanations are probably written in 1842, but there's, I think, an understanding of them that's coming in 1835. They have doctrinal impact on what is happening in 1835. So as you're studying the Doctrine and Covenants, keep in your mind that the saints are getting this. Not everyone has a published copy of the Book of Abraham, but Joseph is teaching from it. And people, there are several copies that are made. We know in 1835, several copies of it are made. And so there's a doctrinal impact that is coming along with the doctrinal impact of the revelations that we're studying in the Doctrine and Covenants. And I'd just love for us to kind of put those two together in our minds as we study it this year. So thanks for your help with that, Stephen.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. As you can probably tell, I like to nerd out about this kind of stuff. And what's not to love about our facsimiles? I wish we had more time for Facsimile 3, but I think that's a good way to sort of dip people's toes into the really richness of our facsimiles, and that we can read them alongside Joseph Smith's revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants. We can also read them within our temple context. My fun little fact I'll leave here, a little tidbit, is we have one account from Nauvoo. A visitor came, he toured Nauvoo, he saw the temple site, he talked with Joseph Smith, and he writes an account that he publishes in a newspaper. And according to this source, Joseph Smith apparently intended to put up the facsimiles and the papyrus in the Nauvoo temple once it was completed. Yeah. And so Joseph Smith seems to have certainly wanted us to read the Book of Abraham and the facsimiles in the context of his revelations and the temple endowment that he's revealing. It ties it all together, all these sorts of elements, right? So next time you go to the temple, when you're in the celestial room and you have a moment, grab the white triple combination they have on the table there and flip through the facsimiles and have a interesting, hopefully profound experience familiarizing yourself with that in that context.
Good. And I'll add to that a little bit and say that for our Patreon website, my kind of bonus material there, I'm going to look at some of the doctrinal impact in the Kirtland Temple, or in the Kirtland area, especially the Kirtland Temple, and that they did put the mummies, and it seems like the papyri, not as sure on that one, but the mummies and maybe the papyri in the temple in Kirtland. It was there when the dedication was happening and so on. We can't nail it down that precisely. Probably when the dedication was happening, if not very, very, very soon thereafter. But the evidence really strongly points towards it being there by then. And so you're right. There's a temple context. Join us for our Patreon group to the bonus material to hear more about that doctrinal impact and some temple ties. And we just want to thank everyone for their support. We love exploring this with you. We're especially grateful for our executive producers. Thank you for your support. And please share some of what you learned with some of your friends in person, via text or something, but reach out individually, make someone's life better by sharing something you learned, some way you were edified, edify someone else. So thank you for joining us, and thank you, Stephen.
Appreciate it, Carrie. Glad to be here.